So I thought I'd start with this diagram here for the, I don't know if this is for the physicists or we're the biologists, but suppose you were an alien biologist and came down to the planet Earth and I guess you landed in the Himalayas or something. This is the first thing you encountered. And, you know, what would you see? You'd see incredible diversity, incredible beauty, and if you were a budding evolutionary biologist or just a biologist who heard about this guy Charles Darwin, you'd be immediately barked on a, you know, your career for the rest of your life trying to explain this diversity and this beauty in terms of some adaptive argument. And so there's this great quote that many of you think are probably familiar with from Darwin's book, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful, most wonderful have been and are being evolved. And then, of course, maybe at the end of your career, you'd find out, geez, these aren't even real organisms, but it was a fun 50-year career or something. But this is done all the time by people in evolutionary biology. You see diversity, it looks beautiful, has to have been created by some force, and that force for us is natural selection. So these are biology snowflakes. And as we've heard over the past few days, particularly with Emmanuel and Sarah's talk, almost all of biology is made out of these things. So most proteins, all proteins, of course, initially come off as monomeric subunits. But as we'll see, only a fraction of proteins in the cell actually operate as monomers. So often two get together and that forms a dimer, or three get together and that forms a trimer or a tetramer, and the list goes on and on and on and on. And they can have various forms. Most of these things, I guess everything I've got up here is a cyclic form. But as Sarah pointed out yesterday, there's all kinds of different higher order forms. But to me, this is one of the big unsolved problems in biology, is why do proteins do this? And the basic questions that might be asked here is this driven by adaptive processes? Is it advantageous for a certain protein to be a dimer in a certain phylogenetic lineage and a monomer in another? And as we'll see, there's a lot of diversity like that that remains unexplained. Or is it just a consequence of the way mutation pressure operates in different lineages, producing adhesive proteins, and a consequence of biophysics of cells? So just to emphasize for those not from a biological background, basically everything you can think about in the cell is made of multimeric subunits. So some of the bigger ones would be the flagellum is a concoction of a large number of proteins, the nuclear pore complex, the hole through which everything flows to the nucleus. The spliceosome is a big complex machine of about 100 proteins. The cytoskeleton, of course, actins and tubulins. I've heard a lot about the centriole the past few days. Even the things that help proteins fold themselves, the chaperones, those are generally fairly large multimers, receptors, ion channels. The list just goes on and on and on, and we'll encounter metabolic enzymes in a few minutes. So this is central to essentially any aspect of cellular biology. There's been a lot of explanations given for why proteins would want to be associated in multimers. So just to back up, when I use the word multimer, I guess there'll be some vocabulary emerging here. When I use the word multimer, I mean that a protein consists of more than two or more subunits. I'm primarily going to be focusing on what are called homomeric enzymes, so all the subunits are encoded by the same genetic locus. I'll talk just briefly about heteromeric molecules. Even the word homomer is a bit blurred, because you can have a situation in a diploid species where you can have variation among the two alleles encoded by the same locus. And so in some sense, that gives rise to a heteromeric molecule when dad's gene is slightly different than mom's gene. So, you know, it's not a completely black and white distinction. So there's been lots and lots of papers written on proteins of these various higher order structures, and there's no shortage of adaptive arguments given in the last paragraph of almost every one of these papers. So one idea is by mixing together subunits, you could increase the structural diversity of the protein. We've seen examples where this might allow you to apply some kinds of allosteric regulations so that some kind of binding of a external ligand or something would cause a conformational change. One thing you might do is if you're a protein, a metabolic enzyme, for example, you'll have a catalytic pocket. And in some sense, that can, by covering up one of your interfaces, in some sense, you can increase the productive surface area of your molecule. I'll be talking a lot generally about multimers in which the subunits retain the same catalytic domain that the ancestral monomer. So there's certainly many, many kinds of multimers where you create an entirely new kind of protein with a new function by, you know, putting various building blocks together. But that's, for the most part, not what I'm talking about. The protein will be carrying out the same function. It's just it's assembled in different ways. Folding might be an issue. So it's we know that the rate of protein folding declines dramatically. I think it's something like e to the square root of the number of amino acids in the chain is how the negative scaling occurs. So it's a lot easier to fold small polypeptide chains than really big ones, and so you might be able to pull that off. Here, it's been argued that you're less vulnerable to denaturation if you're in a multimer rather than a smaller monomer, and the list just sort of goes on and on and on. One thing to keep in mind here is that it's possible that nothing more goes on in the evolution of multimers than this thing here. So instead of there being a real ground-up adaptive basis for evolving a complex protein, the development of interface could be doing nothing more than covering up some kind of surface defect in your protein. So you've got a little nick on your protein. It makes your protein more vulnerable to water. Now you develop an interface and you've covered up that defect, and perhaps nothing is lost. But there are some issues to think about with respect to being a multimeric protein. So there's an encounter rate problem in the cell. So if you want to be a dimer, you're born as a monomer, and you need to find somebody else to match up with in the cell. And that's a concentration-dependent phenomenon. So you're going to be diffusing around, and the rate at which you bump into somebody else is going to be proportional to the square of the concentration of the protein. Another potential issue is that if you're an adhesive protein, you could be adhering to the wrong, some other inappropriate proteins in the cell, and you could cause problems like that. And I'll return to another issue, I guess it's this one here, shortly when I get into some basic population genetic models. And that is, imagine the first, the population of molecules for this gene are all monomers, but the first mutant comes along that wants to be a dimer. So now it's in a cell, it's a rare mutation, it's always in heterozygous form. So now you've got one form of the gene that wants to be a dimer and the other that does not want to be a dimer, and it's an open question what the consequences of that is for the fitness of the organism. And as I said, I'll return to that in a few minutes. So it's tempting to think that there's something good about being a multimeric protein rather than a monomer, and there may be cases that there is something good about it, but as I'm going to be emphasizing, these may be just effectively neutral with respect to each other. But I'll just point, I'm sure someone in the room can point out some clear advantages of some dimer relative to a monomer in some lineage, but I'll just point out several counterexamples just to make the point that it's not, certainly doesn't automatically follow that if you're a dimer, you're better than a monomer, and if you're a tetramer, you're better than a dimer. So for example, there's a famous set of repair machinery that almost all of us have. It's called the mismatch repair pathway. And in bacteria, the mismatch repair machinery operates as monomers. And in eukaryotes, we use dimeric molecules for mismatch repair. It's the same biological phenomenon. It's an error correction procedure for mismatches in the DNA. And from our work, it looks like mismatch repair efficiency is better. More efficient. You're better at catching errors in bacteria than a eukaryote is. So that's one counterexample. I guess I've got three or four of these. We also we use this thing called the sliding clamp for replicating DNA in all of life. In bacteria, the sliding clamp consists of a homodimer. And in eukaryotes, it's a homotrimer. So this is, you're already getting some flavor of how the same homologous structure with common ancestry develops into different forms. And replication fork progression seems to be much faster in bacteria than it is in eukaryotes. Well, you can decide whether having a high rate of replication is good or bad, but I'm just trying to make the point here that things aren't necessarily going better when you add more subunits.
So what's the recommended step for DNA replication? I mean, is it movement in the side of clamp or is it something else?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm just saying this is the rate of fork progression in eukaryotes versus prokaryotes. Bacteria, I should say.
Is something different than the structure of the sliding clamp is in.
Yeah, it might be irrelevant.
Yeah. Does it include also, let's say, NADH dehydrogenase, so you have multi-subunit complex in trimonosomes, and then you have monomeric NADH dehydrogenase. And actually, when you knock down the multi-subunit one or disable it, the monomeric one does the job.
And it's in trypanosomes.
Yeah.
Is already, okay.
And it's so much more simple.
Okay. Yeah, so this is what we're, one of the things we're trying to figure out here is why does complexity evolve at the level of proteins? I know a lot of people are interested in the level of developmental biology, but I'm not ready to go down that road at this point. I'm having a hard enough time at the protein level. Okay, the ribosome. You know, a few ribosomal structures have been figured out. The ribosome is a very complex molecular machine. The heart of it is, of course, RNA. But in eukaryotes, there are many more protein subunits in the ribosome than there are in prokaryotes. And I believe in human, there's quite a few more than in yeast. You know, they're all ribosomes doing more or less the same thing. This is an interesting one as well. So there are these molecules called aminoacyl tRNA synthetases. And in the cell, when we translate messenger RNA into a protein, we have to use intermediate molecules to load the correct amino acid into the ribosome. And those are called transfer RNAs. But the transfer RNAs have to have somebody hand off to them the appropriate protein, appropriate amino acid. And those are called the tRNA synthetases. And it turns out there's an ancient phylogenetic split or genealogical split in the tRNA synthetases. So there's a class called the class 2s, and those are all dimers and tetramers. And there's a class 1, those are all monomeric tRNA synthetases. So each tRNA synthetase deals specifically with a different amino acid. And there's some old, quite nice work on the error rate for tRNA synthetases. So sometimes they're in some sense loosely promiscuous, and sometimes they'll pick up the wrong amino acid. And it turns out the error rate is quite a bit higher than in the family that uses dimers and tetramers. So I'm just trying to, and I don't want to make too much about this, but I'm mainly using this to convey the fact that there is a lot of variation out there among proteins doing essentially the same thing, and it's not necessarily good to be more complex. So this is a summary I put together a few years ago, and this took advantage of a great database that Emmanuel had put together. And so I've spent a lot of time the past 10 or so years trying to understand complexity at the level of genomes and gene structural complexity and so on. So this is trying to move up to a higher level. I'll return to the gene structural thing in a second. But what I was able to do with this great data set, and I assume it's still being updated today, I sure hope it is. What do we have? So a lot of people have tried to look at protein structure in a lot of different organisms. This is all sort of, you know, there's nothing particularly organized going on in here. Different scientists like to study different proteins and different organisms and so on. But what one can at least do is go to a 3D complex here. And I broke things up into six different sort of big phylogenetic groups. Simply asked the question, for example, of all the proteins in eubacteria, at the time there were a little over 4,000, that the 3D structure is known. What proportion are monomers, dimers, trimers, tetramers, and so on? So this is the frequency distribution. And the first bar there are the monomers. And you can see the same thing for the archaebacteria. So those of you who don't recall that are the things we call prokaryotes that don't have nuclear envelopes around their DNA, we break those up into two major groups, the eubacteria. Those are the things, for the most part, growing all over you and in your gut and so on. And then the archaebacteria that live in extreme environments. And then the unicellular eukaryotes, a lot of these guys, of course, are yeast. And in fact, a lot of these guys, it would be E. coli, probably, I don't know, probably at least 25% of the data points in there would be E. coli. And then invertebrates, much smaller number. People who work on invertebrates don't work on protein structure very much, and not a whole lot of data for plants, and what does exist, of course, will be from Arabidopsis. And then there's quite a bit, since we're the scientists, you know, there's quite a bit of data for vertebrates as well, mostly mouse, rat, and human. The main point of this slide is to demonstrate that about, regardless of what group you're in, about two-thirds of proteins that have been recorded in the literature, about two-thirds of proteins are multimers. Only about one-third of proteins are operating as monomers. Okay? And roughly two-thirds of multimers are dimers, and then you can see that these are very crudely negative exponential sort of distributions. Okay? And you can see there's a little bit of oscillation. So if you, the best data would be here, and you can see that, you know, you go down from a dimer or a trimer, you come back up for tetramer, then you go down again for pentamer. So oddmers are a little bit underrepresented with respect to evenmers, and I'll return to that.
Do you have a sense of how much time you spend as a dimer versus a monomer? There's going to be one offering.
I'll talk about that in a second. I don't have, we're working on this, but I don't have a real good quantitative sense. Maybe it depends on a lot of things that as I'll show you. And why don't we return to that when I get to a slide on that? We have an idea what you would need to know, but I don't know that we actually know it inside actual cells for the most part.
Are these data based on crystal structures or biochemical assessments of?
These would be based on crystal structures. There's a lot of data just based on pure biochemical data. I mean, in the old days, you could, certain proteins you could just isolate. Well, you can still do it, but nobody does it anymore. Just isolate your proteins on a starch gel by size and just apply a certain histochemical stain. You can do things like that. There's a lot of different methodologies for doing this. You guys want to comment at all? Or?
Yeah, because I mean, these are not born out.
Yeah, but these are curated, painstaking work by manual, right? These are all curated for the physiological unit as determined by biochemical and biophysical experiments, and then cross-checked with the crystal structure. So it's sort of the most, the best evidence, basically.
Yeah, I would like to believe that Emmanuel has done a great job in curating these, because it is a mess, and if you just go to the literature.
But if you take three sprouts, and you take the biochemical annotation, you will have even more multimers than using PDB.
Exactly.
The one thing that you don't know is these oscillations are basically from the dihedral symmetry of the tetramer, hexamer, octamer, and so on, even numbers. And of course, that you don't have if you don't have crystal structure.
So the main point I want to make with this, and I found quite interesting when I first encountered the data, is obviously you're going from what most of us would call less complex organisms to much more complex cells when we get into eukaryotes. And yet you don't see more complex organisms using more complex proteins on average. I mean, these distributions all look more or less the same. I can't say they're identical by any means. As I pointed out, I'll get to some other data in a second that will get at this in a more explicit way, but this is just what happens to exist in the database. And I think that the obvious kind of work that needs to be done is somebody needs to start going in with the same protein that you know are evolutionary related in different lineages and get a nice balanced data set with structures across multiple lineages. And I'll show you some of this for some metabolic enzymes in a second.
Right, and some of that's been done with some of the structural genomics programs for protozoan presence. We don't necessarily have the biophysical data
yeah.
to support it. But certainly from an X-ray standpoint, there's no difference between trypanosomes and plasmodium and human in this kind of distribution.
In the distribution, but I'll suggest there will be some differences. But the overall distribution is quite remarkable. And the reason I point this out is because this is extremely different than what you see when you look at gene structure and genome architecture. And I think a lot of the people in the room will know this, but when you go to now we're looking at DNA, and if you go to bacterial genomes, this is the cartoon version of a bacterial genome. So a gene would be just one straight open reading frame from start to stop, and there'd be very little space or DNA in between adjacent genes. Not even every gene has a regulatory region, because often genes are co-transcribed in one big polycistronic unit, and then you would have a little area there with small regulatory region. And then as you move into eukaryotes, especially us big multicellular eukaryotes, and this is not appropriate scale, but our coding regions are subdivided into things we call exons. That's where the coding information is. And then the subdivisions there are introns, which have to be spliced out after this gets transcribed. So these all have to be spliced out, and then everything stitched back together in exactly the right way. In humans, the average exon is about 4,500 bases, and the average intron, and the average exon is about 125 bases. So our coding DNA are little tiny islands in this gigantic sea of intronic DNA, and we have much more complex regulatory regions and so on. And so what you see, if you look at coding DNA, for example, scaling is the total genome size. This is a log-log plot, so these are like isoclines. Going from viruses to bacteria and to unicellular eukaryotes, you see they're hugging this is almost the 100% line. So small things, almost all the genome is coding DNA, and then as you get to us big things, things level off. And that's because there's this quantum leap in the amount of DNA inside introns and the intergenic DNA. So the main point I want to make is the pattern we see, I think by almost any standard for protein architectural diversity, is nowhere near as dramatic as what you see at the genome level. And I don't think any amount of sampling is going to change that very dramatically. So that's the big question then. So let's get back now to the protein structure. One problem, as I said, with the data I showed you is we're completely at the mercy of who happened to work on what proteins and in what organisms and so on. We're not necessarily comparing apples with apples or oranges with oranges. So what I decided to do is go through the literature fairly laboriously. I think I did this actually the last time I was at KITP, so it was a productive time. But this was a lot of going through a lot of literature and very carefully. Because there's often discrepancies between different studies and so on. But the main point here is what I did for these different lineages, again, was to focus on a set of proteins in central metabolism. So everybody uses these proteins for the same functions in metabolism. Now, there are some issues here, even with these guys, in vertebrates, sometimes some of these enzymes will have a second function or something. But at least this is getting, you know, maybe we're comparing pears and apples, but not apples and oranges anymore. We're a little closer to, I think, legitimate comparisons. And all I've done here is for these different lineages for each of these proteins, and there are more proteins in central metabolism, of course, but these are the ones for which there's multiple structures to make some kind of conclusion. So all I've done here is I've said, okay, if you're a hexokinase in glycolysis, what flavors do you see in the database for, and this is beyond Emmanuel's database too, because some of these aren't based on structural arguments, they're based on biochemical observations. But for example, if you go into hexokinase, you can find bacteria that use a monomer as hexokinase and others that use tetramers. If you go into archaea, some archaea use monomers, some use dimers, some use tetramers, and so on. And probably, I would not be surprised if all flavors, almost all flavors existed in all lineages. There's not a whole lot of sampling of different species. So, for example, there's some blanks here for land plants just because nobody's looked at the structure of the protein in land plants. That's why there's no data. And the reason for not very much diversity in land plants is, you know, often there'll just be one. The protein was looked at in Arabidopsis and nobody else. So I wouldn't think land plants are special here, but I think you get the point. Even for proteins that have the same function across the tree of life, you don't see metazoans and land plants using protein structures that have a larger number of subunits. So I think this is a pattern that holds up that then remains to be explained.
One thing that I would be wondering is, say if you have a tetramer in bacteria and land plants, is it the same tetramer or is it the
same? I'll show you in a second. Perfect lead in. I think it might be my next slide. Yes, there we go. So this was another, this is really quite an interesting set of observations. So perfect question. So, okay, so archaea, what do we have? A tetramer in archaea, a tetramer in eubacteria, and a tetramer in some metazoan. Are they even, they're all tetramers, but do they have even the same structure or even using the same interface? And so the point is made with this slide here that I think quite clearly. So this is a one of the enzymes involved in lysine biosynthesis. And there's nice crystal structures available for, so here we go, E. coli and N. sylvestris, that's tobacco. A lot of people like to do structural work in tobacco for some reason. I guess you could guess. But in any event, these are tetramers. They're both tetramers, okay? And if you look at, and I think this is what Sarah would call a dimer of a dimer. And if you look at, this would be the monomeric subunit. And if you look at the one in E. coli and the one in tobacco, you know, they look more or less the same, you know, at a gross structural level. But you can see what's going on here is these are both tetramers. They're homotetramers. But you could call this a face-to-face, if you want to call this face-to-face interface, and this would be back-to-back. So if you took this guy off and put it over here, then you would have this. So they're both tetramers, but they're using completely different interfaces, which raises a big question, of course, is how did this happen? There's lots of scenarios you can imagine. One would be that, well, this protein on some lineage was a tetramer for a long period of time. It lost its interface and became a dimer. Maybe even wandered off and became a monomer for a while. Became a dimer again, and then became a tetramer, but now it assembled with a different interface. There's any number of scenarios you could imagine.
I mean, the dimer interface, which is the large interface, seems pretty much the same.
What's that?
So the dimer interfaces, which are the large ones, they seem pretty much the same.
Yeah, okay. So and this wasn't a good...
On the left-hand right. Side, the dimer is dimer. So the large interface is conserved. On the left-hand
yeah,
side,
that's right.
It seems
yeah.
extremely small. Can I ask you to not scratch the... Like, with your stick, don't scratch the board.
Sure.
It hurts my ears.
Oh. I guess my ears aren't that sensitive. I don't even hear it. I'm sorry.
But so the left one looks really, really small and big to me.
Yeah. Anyhow, those are the data. I'm just trying to this is leading up to, and this isn't restricted to that one particular protein. Here's another example with one of the superoxide dismutases that we use to deal with free radicals. And the top one is a bacterium, again, a bacterial eukaryote comparison. The bottom one is cow. There's lots of protein data for cows. I misspoke on the rat mouse thing. There's a lot of protein available for cows. So there's quite a few things done for cows. And there's a different interface. And there's a paper from Anna Panchenko's lab. Anna's going to be here, I think, in 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. They went through the database and that existed and estimated about two-thirds of protein families for which more than one structure was known exhibited variation in the binding interfaces. So, and again, there's a lot of caveats in these observations and so on, but I think it's pretty clear that there's phylogenetic sort of fluidity in the state that particular proteins can be in different lineages. And so this is one of the things we'd like to understand evolutionarily is how this happens. I thought I'd put up a couple points. These are just sort of, before I get into some of the theory sides, this point's come up before. I just wanted to make sure everybody understood. So some more vocabulary. When we talk about an interface, one kind of interface would be called isologous, so that you're, I'm not very good at geometry, but, well, I guess this would be isologous, right? So the palm of your hand. And now think about this being an interface here, and imagine a mutation arises, so you're a monomer. You're not talking to each other, but then something happens here in a residue that makes you adhesive to something over there. And then when you rotate things, this is what has been referred to as the two for the price of one, right? So this here is the same as that there, and you've just rotated things. So I think Monod first made this point many, many years ago. Okay, and so this is it's a potential reason why it's, you know, I'll return to this in another sense, but it's a potential reason why homomers are a bit easier perhaps to get off the ground than a heteromer, because the heteromers you generally won't get two for the price of one. Okay, so this has been referred to a couple times. Some other ways to get things off the ground, co-localization helps. So if you're a monomeric protein, I've already made the point that one thing you got to worry about is finding a partner in the cell. And, you know, if there's some mechanism that ensures that the partners are kept to a restricted place in the cell, this will increase the effective encounter rate.
So do you have any idea how important it is that proteins are being produced from the same messenger RNA, so they're initially co-localized for that reason. How quickly do they diffuse off into the cells? So is it
I think this is something that Sarah is working on. It's something I've often wondered about. She's probably the best person to answer.
I mean, so for homomers, if you have a high enough ribosome concentration on the same mRNA, then that will happen on the polysome.
Right.
So you automatically have co-localization during translation if there are enough ribosomes sitting on one mRNA.
Yeah, so
for homomers. So this is exactly.
Yeah, so the question is a good point. Do things diffuse? So if you looked at Adrian Elcock's wonderful animation, looks like things diffuse pretty fast. And I think there are some measurements of how fast things diffuse in cells.
Yeah, but you're right that there is. So I think I haven't thought about this much before, actually, before you said it, but that, you know, if you have a weak, initially, like a weak mutation, how the hell, you know, very, very high, I don't know, micromolar KD or something, you have to have a high concentration in the cell for that protein to find its partners and so on. But actually, on the polysome, they'll be very densely co-localized. At least initially, like from a kinetic point of view.
So it's the time frame.
Yeah, the time frame, yeah.
It's about 500 amino acids per second.
How much is it, five?
I think it's about 5 amniotic per second deflection. And 1 second, you basically go to the other side of the cell. So you have to have another domain to kind of keep the domains together during the translation. If the protein is not folded, by the time the other one finishes, because the ribosome is about, I don't know, 6 amino acids, so it could be already to the other side of the cell. So it would have to be folded while being still held by the ribosome. So it would have to have another domain to, I guess,
so it would have to be reaching back and connecting.
Yeah.
So in general, then you might think that once it's released from the message, it's gone before the next one has
come. Yeah, if it's not folded yet, I think it will probably be gone before it's folded and able to interact.
Yeah. Unless it basically
unless you have
folds and attracts.
Yeah.
No, unless it's literally
folding
and immediately the N-terminal residues are involved in the attract.
Which would mean that the message would have to be like curved around so that you could.
Yeah.
It seems awkward.
Well, eukaryotes often do that. The mRNAs are circular. You just keep going around.
But just getting the right domain that's already folded to reach back and get
right. But anyhow, there is you can think of some simple cellular features that ensure you're more co-localized than random. And I'll show you a neat example where this plays potentially a big role as well. Proteins, the surface of proteins are by definition almost hydrophilic, typically. So this means that often if you get a mutation that affects a surface residue, it's going to be sticky just because there's a sort of built-in bias. So that's another point. So I just thought I'd throw this up here just to help people get their heads around this odd-mer, even-mer thing. So, I just pointed out that the 2 for the price of 1 is a nice way to get things off the ground with one mutation if you use an isologous interface. But, and so this is a ring now, right? And you can see the red is matching with the red and the black is matching with the black. This happens to have 2 interfaces because I made a ring. And that works, you could use a heterologous interface there, so black likes red instead of black likes black, and that works nicely for a dimer. And this, you can, now we have 3 subunits, and the heterologous interface works well, right? Because for every 1 black, there's 1 red, so every, you know, the math works out. But if you're using isologous interfaces, well, you can match 1 red up with 1 red, and 1 black with 1 black, but now you're left with a black and a red. And in this case, black doesn't like red. So that's one potential issue with an odd-mer.
Can I be a nitpicky physicist?
Absolutely.
So each of these is a 3D object, which is a chiral thing. So they have to be the same, right?
Yeah.
And so that means, so what I was struggling with yesterday with this dimer of dimers is the fact that some of them have to be upside down, because otherwise they would be mirror image. If I just believe your bottom left diagram there, it looks like a mirror image. It looks like you've got two kinds of thing there, right? So it only works if one of them is upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to really know that. I mean, yeah.
That's what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I worked out eventually with your thing. That was right.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I was showing in that previous diagram. Things got flipped, right? That's how you get the 2 for the price of 1.
So,
right. That's
left and a right hand. It's 2.
That's
right.
This.
Yeah.
And then this, I think, slightly came up. There is an issue too. With heterologous interfaces, because unless you've got the right angles set up, you'll never meet, right? So you could end up with open fibrils or helices, as I think Wallace pointed out yesterday. So I'm just trying to, I think that's all the basic vocabulary that I sort of, just to get everybody on the same page, because it gets a bit bewildering sometimes. I thought maybe the question would come out about what is the incidence of, I've been talking about homomers, right? So all the subunits are encoded by the same genetic locus, but there are things called heteromers, right? And the different subunits are encoded by different genetic loci. So in hemoglobin, I guess in humans, it's what the beta subunit and the alpha come together. It's a tetramer, so it's a little more complicated. But a heteromer means that some of the subunits come from different genetic, they're encoded by different genetic loci. This is, I think, extremely rough. So this is just data from eubacteria, unicellular eukes. So this would be largely yeast again. This would be largely E. coli. And I guess this would be largely cow or human. But just to give you a rough idea, these are the fraction of proteins in these different domains that are monomers, homomers, and heteromers. So, you know, vaguely looks like there are fewer heteromers, but I'm sure there's a huge bias here based on, it's a lot easier to crystallize a homomer than a heteromer, so there's probably some big biases here. It also looks like, relatively speaking, heteromers are more common in invertebrates than they are in lineages, other lineages, but I'll just put this out there. I don't want to make too much about the absolute numbers, but that's sort of what we have at this point. And that's part of the point here is, you know, without a very organized study of the same protein across many lineages, it's going to be hard to really know how big the biases are here. A couple things that I probably won't talk much more about heteromers at all, but there are a couple constraints on evolving a heteromer, right? If you're a heteromer, you're effectively doubling the mutation rate to your complex because you can now you can break either of the genes and you've broken the complex. So in some sense, that's not so good. And there may also be issues of stoichiometric imbalance, right? If you're a heteromer, you would like both of your genes to be expressed at the same level so you don't end up with a lot of one flavor floating off there by itself, maybe causing problems.
So I'm wondering, I mean, I know that you're moving along an idea that at least for homomers, there may not be an adaptive feature to why it happens, but I wonder if that's also true for heteromers, because when I just think about the heteromeric proteins that I know of, it seems like formation of a heteromer may more often give you something new.
Yeah, it's quite conceivable, sure.
Because so the homomers you're really looking at are the things that have maintained their ancestral function. They're just stuck together in different ways. Mm-hmm. But with a heteromer, it seems like there's more.
Many ways you could become a heteromer. That's for sure.
But just more things that I mean, that may be a rich source of innovation.
It's possible.
Forming a homomer may not be.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether for heteromers, if the argument might be much more strong than the adaptive side.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's been it's quite amazing to me, there's been very little thought given to this particular question, since all of biology is based on multimeric subunits. You know, everybody focuses on, you know, the functions, catalytic functions of individual proteins and so on, does a great job of that, and there's tons of stuff out there on KCAT and so on, but there's a lot of open questions, so I don't disagree at all.
So I think that active sites are often located at dimeric or trimeric interfaces. And
sometimes, yeah. But those metabolic enzymes that I put up there, I think there was one of those that did that. So yeah, what could happen is you make a new catalytic site at the interface. That right. Could happen, right? I'm trying to focus on proteins where that's not happening. So yeah, in I'm some sense, two monomers have the same number of catalytic sites as one dimer.
Okay. Yeah. Just maybe one comment related to your comment. So with Christian, who has been now your step, we did show that a lot of the phosphorylation sites inside the cell are just there by chance. And these are the product of hetero interactions.
In some sense,
kinase, the kinase wandering around, finding a substrate, turning out it phosphorylates it, and this is just because it found it by chance.
It's erroneous.
Yeah.
Possible. So, well, Shelley, you weren't here last week. Shelley works on promiscuous enzymes, so there you go.
It's not, I wouldn't say it's erroneous. Oh, it's just neutral.
Yeah, it's just brown.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take a cyanide and you want to test it with any protein, it's really it's high enough concentration to be phosphorylated, I guess. So I mean, that is happening, not to some extent inside the cell.
You said the application of the kinase substrate.
Yeah. I mean, not this, I just identify random identification.
Non-biologically significant.
Yeah.
Non-adaptive.
Okay, so there were a lot of the data that I showed you, sort of what seems to be the existing pattern, the amount we can glean out of the existing data. And you heard a lot more about this from Emmanuel. And
dimers, are they isologous? Or, I mean, when you look at the distribution of dimers,
they have to be isologous.
They have to be isologous.
Otherwise, they make fibrils.
Okay, so what I would like to do is to try and think about this from I mean, those are the data. And, you know, as an evolutionary biologist, I would like to understand why these patterns exist, how they evolve. And there's actually two ways of thinking about things mechanistically here. I've done some work in population genetics, so not surprisingly, I'll focus on that mostly. But I do want to emphasize there's a lot of biophysics and biochemistry, especially biophysics going on here, in terms of explaining how things, you know, there's an encounter rate problem, there's a binding interface strength problem, and so on. And I'll provide you with at least one slide on that. But the basic population genetic questions that to me are of relevance is how do these transition rates? So you can imagine what must be going on with many of these proteins is that over, you know, many hundreds of millions of years of evolution, they must be transitioning in some lineage from a monomeric type to a dimeric type and so on. It seems very likely, and tetramer maybe and so on, and probably able to move back and forth. And so the question is what governs those evolutionary transition rates from one state to another? Does it depend on population size, mutation rates, and so on? And what are the paths of evolution, because it's great to do comparative biology, but I want to know what the mechanisms of evolution are, because we can make up a lot of stories about what happened, whether it's adaptive, non-adaptive, but for example, I would like to know what the pattern would be if there was no natural selection driving things. What's the neutral hypothesis? Because then, and there is a question about how do we even develop a neutral hypothesis, but if we had one that we agreed on, and the data did not fit the expected pattern, then we'd be on stronger grounds for arguing for adaptive diversification. How many changes does it take to make a new architectural state? You know, how many changes does it make to make a binding interface or to lose one? It turns out, I guess we know, it doesn't take very many. You said two the other day, right? So roughly, yeah. And sometimes just one to break one, I guess sometimes. What about the intermediate states? If it takes more than one mutation, is the first state deleterious, which causes problems, as we'll see in a second, because you're great if you get the second one, if it's advantageous to be over there, but how do you get, you know, if it's very bad to be on first base, how do you get to second base? And as I pointed out, you know, are the so-called final states, does it even matter to the organism? So just one slide on the biophysics, biochemical aspect of this I thought I'd point out, because I think it is quite relevant to try to understand what's going on, to think inside the cell. So this is a graduate student of mine from our physics department, Kyle Hagner. And we've been working on this model that provides a prediction. Given the basic biology of the system, we're able to predict what number of our protein in a cell will be floating around as monomers and what as dimers. We're just starting out we've done some stuff with tetramers, so let's just focus on monomer, dimer. And a key thing to mention here that we always tend to forget. I think many of you know that, I mean, strictly speaking, there's not something that, there's very few things that could be regarded as 100% dimer and 100% monomer, because there's an association dissociation going on constantly. And so there's really a population of one type versus the other. And as we'll see, typically you're probably mostly in a phase where almost everybody's a dimer or almost everybody is a monomer, but there are some interesting intermediate regions where there'll be, you know, something like 50-50 mix. Anyhow, the way to think about this is to start from first principles. So this is DNA, and then we've got our gene that's going to make the protein, and it's going to have a certain rate of transcription. And so this is the rate of association with the transcription factor with the binding site for this gene. And this is just, these are related to K, what are called K-on and K-off. It's the binding, the rate at which the transcription factor binds and falls off. And then there's going to be, given that the transcription factor is on there, then there's going to be a certain rate of transcription. So here we're turning DNA into our messenger RNA. So V sub zero is the rate of transcription. And transcripts decay at pretty high rates, really quite high rates, on the order of typically minutes in the cell. So there's a decay rate of these guys. And then transcripts, of course, find a ribosome, and they get translated at some rate, V1. And off comes your monomeric subunit. And now you've got multiple monomeric subunits floating around the cell. I don't know why we use D in both of these, but you can think about this is the association rate, and then this is the dissociation. Once you're a dimer, you can dissociate. So that's what dictates sort of a steady state frequency of these two flavors. And then the monomers have a decay rate, D sub 1, and the dimers have a decay rate, D sub 2. We assume that the decay rate of a dimer is much lower than it is of a monomer. But the main point is that these are the sort of the key coefficients that are relevant to defining. So what will happen is if you let these run in the life cycle of a cell, you'll reach an equilibrium distribution of numbers of these proteins, the singletons and the doubletons. And that actually varies among cells. So because transcription rates are so low, many transcripts have an average number of copies of only two or three in the cell. So sometimes cells won't even have an mRNA for a particular protein, and then the gene will come back on. Fortunately, the half-lives of proteins are longer than of mRNAs. So, you know, you run out of an mRNA, you still got protein in your cell. But these decay rates and the production rates define what will happen in the cell.
Like a few comments.
Sure.
For our physicist friend here, like you've drawn it as though it's an open fibril.
Oh yeah, that's bad. Sorry.
You need to fix it.
Yeah. yeah, exactly.
And then the other little kind of comment is that the way you've drawn it, it's like folding and then assembly. Or it's like the first step V1 is translation and folding, kind of rolled in.
Yeah.
But there could be two different scenarios. One is that you translate and it's the folding and assembly kind of happens together, so there's mm-hmm. things like that.
Yep.
And others where you really have a proper monomeric intermediate that folds and then assembles. So I don't know that would, whether it's worth separating those two.
So
think about it a bit more.
You suggest to give even more coefficients. There are already quite a few.
Yeah, I mean, guess what you would think, the way we've got it, the folding rate would be in here. Because if you don't fold fast enough, you're going to go down this route. So in some sense, they're embedded. But yeah, thank you for catching that. I didn't do the artwork, I'll say. But we don't want that to be in the figure for sure. Okay. But anyhow, you get the general flavor. And one reason for pointing this out is we have measurements of these decay rates for all the proteins in about three or four I guess up to 7 species or so, mostly bacteria, but we have an idea of what these are, and we have an idea of what those are. And similarly, we have measures of transcription rates and translation rates. So we at least to an order of magnitude know what these numbers ought, you know, where they ought to be. And if you know all this, this is a stochastic sort of setting. But what you can do is now imagine we have a population of cells and these things are happening stochastically, and you can end up predicting the number of molecules per cell of both types. And this has been done in the past for just single mRNAs or single proteins. But Kyle was able to extend this to actually and get an analytical solution for what we call the quasi-steady state distribution of the numbers of these and these in a cell. So just keep in mind that a population of cells will vary in the exact number in the cells just because of the stochasticity of these rates. And so, for example, for a certain set of conditions, what we're looking at here is imagine, so delta G is a measure of the binding strength of the interface, and that's going into stuff up here. So all I want to make the point is for a certain set of parameters, this would be for a protein. Everything else equal, I don't remember what the background parameters are, but the delta G of 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. And this is simply asking then, what would the distribution of monomers versus dimers be? And you can see as you go into a point where you have a stronger interface, almost all the proteins are dimers. And way over here, the interface is relatively weak, so everybody, nothing else is changing here except the strength of the binding interface. And so, you know, you go in this direction, now you're what people would call a monomer. There is a region in the middle where, you know, you could be 50, you'd have to be, there has to be an intersection, so there is a region where in the cell you'd be 50-50.
And that's kcal per mole?
Pardon me?
So kilocalories per mole?
I think so, kcal per mole.
That seems like not very physical. Like,
I think interfaces are similar, typically around, you know, order of magnitude 10-ish, right? 10 kcal per mole, I think.
That's why I'm puzzled.
Seems awfully strong.
It seems really strong.
Certainly for...
Well, this is for a whole binding interface. Yeah, I think this is what Topic has found in their paper. It's around, I think the average interface strength is around 10.
That's very strong.
Just looking up for a couple of structures of central metabolism enzymes that we solved it.
Well, I mean, you can, we started at zero, right? I'm just saying what would happen if these are the values. And I could show you an infinite number of graphs like this. I'm just trying to make the point that if you know these coefficients, we can predict what would be in the cell.
Well, it probably depends on the other depends on the other code.
There's a lot going on here.
Yeah. What are the whiskers?
Yeah, so this is what I'm trying to get at. So what this is from computer simulation. So
the red is on top of the blue. Is that it? No.
No, I don't know why. That's the mean. So these red, these dashes are the average number of monomers and dimers. And this is, I don't remember what this is, one of these whisker things, and I don't remember whether this is the full range and the standard deviation. I don't remember, but mainly what I want to point out is the smooth lines, those are the analytical solutions. So this is a complex model, so it's pretty impressive to be able to pull off the analytical solution. So what this means then, if you change any of these parameters, you'll change where these curves reside. And you'll notice over here, of course, the dimers is smaller than the number of monomers, but keep in mind a dimer has two molecules, so this is single dimers. So if you wanted to know the total number of proteins, you'd multiply this by two, and it would in fact exceed this. And part the reason for that is once you're a dimer, you have a lower decay rate. So once you get over there, you're in some sense protected.
is there some noise introduced into these parameters, or some stochasticity, and you know, when something gets produced, is that why, that's why you've got the variability?
Yeah, these are stochastic equations. The cell is firing these different things at certain rates per unit time, and there's a thing called the Gillespie algorithm that people can use. There's a lot of ways to do this, but the bottom line is, you know, we have an analytical solution, which I think is quite useful, because it, the point here is that if you really up your translation rate, you'll push something towards the dimeric end of things, just because there's more proteins there to encounter each other. So it's a way to get things off the ground evolutionarily. That's mainly what I'm trying to point out the biophysics for. And then you can, this is now a sort of a bivariate thing. This is saying, okay, so here you just looked at a gradient of delta G, and here we're looking at where you would be if you had, so what are there, 7 parameters or something up here? 2 of them were allowing to vary, so the transcription rate and the binding strength. And so you see, as you go in this direction, this is the fraction of the proteins that will be dimers. And so as you go in this direction, you're dimeric because there's a lot more protein there because of the higher transcription rate. And as you go in this direction, of course, the binding strength is higher, and you go in the dimeric range. So you get this sort of phase transition, depending on what the parameters are. That's the main point. And so this, it helps provide a way to think about it. You know, I think it's a nice organizing principle, because it means if we, and E. coli is probably the best case, you know, there's a couple thousand proteins or something, I think, in E. coli, we know the structure. So if we happen to know, and I guess for those, we would know what this is and this. But now I think about it, I mean, there's protein degradation rates, but I don't know if they've been partitioned up into this versus this. I almost certainly not. But this does suggest what you need to know if you want to make predictions about whether a protein is going to be predominantly monomeric or dimeric. And I think it helps define what we even mean by monomer and dimer. Okay.
Even if you didn't know those rates, you could still measure the concentration of protein. You could just say how many of these proteins are there per cell, and you expect to see more.
And that's been done.
High concentrations. Yeah. Is that known in the data?
There are.
The problem is that I was thinking exactly the same thing.
No, there are about 7 species for which we have estimates of the mean number of proteins in a cell.
Yeah.
You have to spike your cell preparation and so on, but there's about 4 for which we know the mean number of mRNAs per cell. So those are the sort of steady state. But you know, those are also cells grown generally at, you know, something approximating warp speed, you know, in the chemistat and so on.
Well, I think the issue isn't that. So the issue is that all the proteins, you know, they're pretty much, you're not going to see anything that's really deleterious in a kind of natural, you know, organism that you're measuring. And so even though, like what you're saying is basically, in order to get an oligomer, you have to have a certain expression level initially to kind of push you over, you wouldn't necessarily see that in the organism, because you're going to have very few things that are actually kind of evolving in that way.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be selected.
Right. I mean, what this is telling us is there's certain values of all these parameters that have to be satisfied to be predominantly monomeric or dimeric.
The continuity, the most important parameter is KD or KA, in which this one we have no data on most proteins.
Right.
There's
less than a handful. I mean, there is some information on it, but. I think the point being made here is these are the key parameters you'd want to actually get measurements on. We're trying to distill the system down to sort of the minimum. And of course, unfortunately, the minimum has still got a number of parameters that we need to worry about.
So you said that we know the concentrations of proteins in cells for 7 species. How are those measured?
Mass spec sorts of approaches. But you have to standardize everything. There's other ones that are done with GFP times kinds of things where it doesn't work so well with really abundant proteins, of course, but I think somebody's pointed out some data like this in a talk here or something.
Yeah, yeah, mass spec and fluorescence, oxygen.
But with mass spec,
no, but nowadays they're pretty good techniques that are yeah.
But not for absolute concentrations.
No, 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 you can.
Unless you.
You can translate and, I mean, I'm not an expert in mass spectrometry, but from what I've read, it's quite now accurate. I mean, you can relative, yes.
Yeah,
you basically have the relative abundances, and you know the total protein content inside the cell, and then you kind of normalize it to a concentration. So the mass spec won't give you the concentration, but it gives you the relative abundances across the entire organism.
And so most of these techniques are done with populations of cells, right? So you're getting the mean number per cell. You're getting, you can get this for mRNAs
I'm
and proteins.
I'm skeptical because ions fly so differently. So you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, getting
the quantitative. I mean, we don't do this either, although we've sent a lot for mass spec, but we wind up supporting lots of such data sets from various different organisms, and we can claim to the contrary. I think the quantitative nature of that has just not been very reliable to date, depending on at least for large scale.
No, but the really top mass spec, like cutting edge techniques, like the MAN, like Matthias MAN and
we have a lot of data from Matthias's group, but I think that he would still agree that so certainly for cytoplasmic extracts, yes. But there are lots of classes of proteins that for which it's just
the quantitative nature is just not very
accurate because of exactly these issues as to what fragments and what flies.
It's also the proteins.
And for the cell-to-cell variation, this microscopy techniques like Jonathan Weissman and so on, they do also use some cell-to-cell variation.
I mean, it's fair to say it's still at its infancy, but it's also clear that this is, you know, the bugs will eventually get pulled out, and this is something that is on the edge of doable in multiple organisms, I think. Okay, so I want to get on to the evolution stuff. We're in an hour or so. So I want to think about this now as a population geneticist and just think about how a system like this evolves. And, as I said, I would like to start out with a neutral model. It becomes hard even to be absolutely certain how you define a neutral model now for a system like this. So we always use fitness. We call fitness W in honor of Sewell Wright. And so you might think that fitness is some function of the number of monomers of your protein plus some weighting factor. You had a question.
Yes, I was just interested in, do you know what sets the width of this intermediate range?
Of this?
The interface between the two regions.
This?
Yes.
I'd say yes, we do know, but it's not simple. It depends on a lot of these things. Some of these things come in, fortunately, as ratios, which reduces the dimensionality of the problem, but
it's just so, nice because it looks so much like an interface of like two-phase interface region.
Well, all we're doing, I mean, at this point, you're getting to the point where the binding strength is really quite high, and I think that's why that happens. But this would be shallower if you had lower transcription rates and translation, because there'd be fewer encounters, and so it depends on multiple things all at the same time. Okay, so how would you even define fitness? If you wanted to have a neutral model, fitness would be constant across everybody, but you do require the enzyme to be working. And so you might think that fitness is just that weighting factor would be 2. A dimer's got 2 molecules, so we'll just count it as 2 monomers, as simple as that. And then you might say that the fitness is going to increase hyperbolically, because once you get to high level of expression, you're not going to gain anything. But there's also cost functions here too, because to have a certain number of monomers and dimers, that's a function of the degradation rate and so on. And it, you know, you have to maintain a steady state number of these things in the cell. So there's going to be an energetic cost to the cell if you want to go in this direction. That's the point I was making before. So there's some unsolved issues here, and even how to set up the a model that connects with the biophysics. I just want to make that point. But I want to sort of go through a general procedure that I think we can use to get at this issue. So now imagine that we're just talking about a dimer, and as I've just pointed out, you know, there's different ends of the spectrum. So you might imagine at this end, this is one state in which the molecule can be in. It has no hope of binding anybody. And then as we move to the right, we're in different states in which there's different strength of binding. So here maybe you picked up one residue that makes you sticky, and then here there's two maybe and three. And so you can just imagine going across to different states of the molecule. And what will happen over evolutionary time, a population has a certain probability of existing in these different states. Mutations will rise wherever you are, and you'll have a certain probability of fixing, and so on. And the way this is set up is, so what we're thinking about now is just following a lineage through evolutionary time for a long period of time, and then we want to ask, what's the probability it's residing in these different states? And you can apply this to any evolutionary problem, but I think it's quite manageable here. So these are evolutionary transition rates, and they have there's a simple way to say what these are. So there's going to be a certain rate at which mutations arise from this type to that type. For a haploid, that's the number of individuals times the mutation rate that makes that type. And then you have to weight that by the probability of the mutation actually fixing. Okay, so that's the standard way this would work. So there's ways of defining these things in population genetic terms. So the product of the number of mutations arising per generation times the fixation probability. Now, the physicists in the room will be familiar with this kind of model immediately. What will happen, if you know what these coefficients are, as long as there's no blanks in the middle and there's not, and I'm going to have the prevailing pressure to the left, this whole system will reach an equilibrium. And that means that equilibrium defines the probability of a population, a lineage, whatever, being in a certain state over long periods of evolutionary time.
That, of course, requires that your sequence here is an endom on the right hand side. Otherwise, it won't go in definitely.
Yeah, it assumes an end on the right side. I think it won't go indefinitely if the prevailing pressure is to the left. Am I wrong on that?
I
think it makes its boundary essentially naturally, right? Because
it depends.
Yeah. Anyhow, the way I worked it out, I left it open-ended, and it still equilibrates. But there's this thing called detailed balance, which is useful to think about, because when the system equilibrates, it means that the rate of flow into any one state has to equal the rate of flow in the opposite direction. And so if you just think of this as being, you know, our ideal monomer and that a dimer, what this would predict, if this is what happens, if life has reached equilibrium, there ought to be on the whole tree of life the same rate of monomer to dimer transitions as vice versa. Otherwise, life wouldn't be in equilibrium. I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying that this is what would have to be observed. And what's nice about this system is, it's complicated. It looks complicated, but it turns out that if you want to calculate the probability of being in any one of these states, it turns out mathematically quite tractable. So if, for example, you want to know what's the probability of being in that state, it's just the product of all the coefficients on the errors pointing up to it and all those pointing down. So you can actually solve this in this particular case. And so that's what I'm doing here. So let's now imagine a neutral model. And the math works out quite nicely here. So under neutrality, remember that the rate of transition, this is the beauty of the neutral theory, is just dependent on the mutation rate, right? Because there's N individuals mutating in this direction, in this case, at rate u, but the probability of fixation is 1 over n. So n being the population size, it cancels out. So this is the neutral theory. The rates of transitions depend on the on nothing more than the rate of mutation. So let's say that you're gaining bonds or something like that going to the right at rate u. Okay, so, and we'll assume that there's a lot of open territory for interface. So for all practical purposes, this stays the same as you go to the right. But then this is the loss of a binding site. And so here it's V because there's only one site involved. Here it's 2V. Here it's 3V and so on. So there is this prevailing pressure to the farther you get to the right, the faster you move to the left, so to speak. And so if you work, use that procedure that I just pointed out, you can work all this out and you get the probabilities of being these different states. It turns out to be a function of just one parameter. It's the ratio of the mutation rate to the right, u, to the mutation rate to the left, v. And some of you might recognize this form of that distribution. That's the Poisson distribution. So with the Poisson parameter u over v. And so what this is saying is that there's prevailing mutation pressure to the left, which would be here, u is 1/10 of v. You know, you almost always be in the monomeric state. I mean, it should be fairly intuitive. And as there's mutation pressure to the right, these distributions move over to the right. But keep in mind that there's a fairly high probability of being in any one of these states. So you can imagine that you would reside in these different states at a certain probability over time. So that's the idea here. I think the important thing to think about it evolutionarily is every population has experienced the same mutation rates, but they don't reside in the same states at any one point in time. There's flux up and down here. The whole system is in equilibrium. But if you looked at many lineages exposed to the same mutation rates, there's a certain probability of being here, 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 and here. So that's the idea. And so that's
why is u over v? What does mutation bias mean? Because I mean the mutation rate is just is the mutation rate, right? It doesn't matter whether it's going left or right.
If u equals v, there's no net bias in going this direction versus that direction.
But that, I mean, in terms of mutations, there's no reason to expect any bias. There's a selection on one of its dimer, then yes, but otherwise it
well, you may be right. I mean, I'm just leaving this open. So we're allowing for u not to be equal to v. Maybe u is equal to v, but u is the rate of gain of some unit of adhesion, and v is the rate of loss, and they might not be the same. So that's all this is saying. If they are the same, then this is the expectation.
So if they're not the same, is it because different kinds of mutations will make you more sticky?
Yeah, so that's why I left this sort of open. You know, it's a lot easier to break something usually than it is to form something. So, I mean, if you want them to be both the same, then that's fine. This is just showing you what the if there's no net pressure to the right or the left, you still have variation in where you'll be. Okay, and that's mainly the point, that you'll have stochasticity among lineages, and of course that's what we see with the data. Because it's all stochastic. You're randomly fixing into one class and another and so on. Okay, so what happens if you...
What's a Leland class?
Pardon me?
What's the x-axis?
These are just arbitrary classes with different bindings.
Oh, classes, okay.
And they're all neutral right now, okay? So I'm just trying to come up with a neutral model for what we'd expect. And I'm certainly open to alternative neutral models, but... the point is we'd like to have one to compare what would, if you would expect anything different with selection. So let's think of one, the problem with selection is selection can, you can come up with any selective scenario, right? This is part of the problem. This is why we don't use selection as the neutral, as the null model, because there's, you know, infinite number of selection scenarios, but ideally there's one neutral scenario. So let's now, my computer may have just locked itself up, unfortunately. Oh, well. I think I'm going to start over again. Not the whole talk. I've got just a couple more slides.
So one comment then, if your U is the same at each of those steps, it's like saying that you don't run out of surface area. If there was a finite amount of surface area, then each time you make a sticky mutation, you've got reduced numbers of them. Right? So if you had a finite surface area, that would be gradually reducing the U as you go across. And then you just end up with the binomial instead.
That's
of
right. Those U's could be going down as you go across.
Yes. So
right.
You just end up with the binomial right. instead of a puzzle. Then.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's
normal. Let's see what happens. And you know, you could argue that the mutation rates are different on every one of those arrows, right? That you know, it's easier to get one bond than two or. You know, there's any number of ways that this could be altered, but the main point that I want to make is, and we have the basic structure set up for models like this. Let's see. We'll get lucky and it will just appear. Okay, so we just saw the neutral case, and then we can say, well, what happens if we want to apply selection? So let's say there's directional selection favoring the dimeric state, and that the selective advantage of this guy relative to this is equal to S, some small number. And this guy has an advantage over that equal to S. So this is a very simple selection model, but there's progressive advantage as you go to the right. And it turns out if you do the math, it doesn't change things qualitatively very much at all. So sure, I hope you like this. This is your number that you talked about in physical terms the other day. It turns out that e to the 4n, if you think of the probability of fixing a beneficial mutation in this direction, you can also think of the probability of fixing a deleterious one in this direction. And the ratio turns out to be 4nes. Okay, so that is just a multiplier going across the right. If this is bad, then s would be negative, and you'd be pushing to the right. But this is in effect a measure of the selection bias in one direction. So this was the mutation bias in one direction, just U over V, and all we've done now is, this is just the net pressure to the right, is basically what it is. Or as I said, it could be to the left if S were negative. And so, not surprisingly, this gives you another Poisson. It's just that the Poisson parameter has changed. It's a mixture of the mutation pressure and the selection pressure and drift. Because if the population size is smaller than the reciprocal of selection coefficient, this is very close to zero, and this term doesn't even matter. And you're right back to the neutral theory. So this sort of generalizes things. And so again, you get the Poisson distribution with that. The disappointing thing about this is that the distribution is a composite function of the mutation rate, of the magnitude of selection, and the power of drift. So it's not immediately easy to see how you can tease these things apart. Now, I just picked one selection model, so we could have any number of different models here. You could decide this is the optimum, and then there's a Gaussian or something, but you could play more or less the same game. So mainly, you can do this with tetramers too. I'm going to skip over this. We've developed it for tetramers, and then you can predict the probability you're monomeric, dimeric, or tetrameric, depending on the strength of selection. So it's just an extension of the previous model. But the main thing I want to just summarize this in words is that the one point that these models make is that you can have substantial amounts of variation in the phenotypic state of the population, whether you're monomer, dimer, or tetramer, even when exactly the same selection, and exactly the same power of drift, and exactly the same power of mutation is being applied to everybody. Everybody will not arrive at the same point. You'll wander through it with the same probability over time, but you'll get these distributions naturally. And that's, of course, I think, relevant to thinking about the data and just seeing those exponential distributions and trying to make, you know, statements about if it's good to be one type versus the other. The other thing to realize here is that the most common type doesn't have to be the optimal type. So if there was really strong prevailing mutation pressure in this direction, and there was selection in this direction, the most common type won't be the extreme over there, because both things are operating at the same time. And we have this clear habit in biology, in evolutionary biology, of just going out and looking at the most common type and deciding that's the optimal phenotype, and then trying to concoct a story about evolution around it. But if there's any kind of mutation bias, the most common type will not be the optimal type. And then finally, if that composite quantity for any S, that's just nothing more than the ratio of the power of selection to the power of drift. And so if that number is less than one, drift wins. That means drift wins. Even if there's selection going on, the noise in the process is being overwhelmed by random genetic drift. And I just realized I need to apologize to the physicists, because we use the word drift in completely different ways than you guys do, right? For the physicists, drift is the directional force. And for us in population genetics, it's the random force. So anyhow, I think those are the, there's other ways to extend. I'm just going to do this verbally very quickly. There's one really great model that is very seductive about very quickly evolving a dimer. I'm not going to go into the theory, but it's called the domain swapping model. And there are molecules that are set up with, say, two domains that bind to each other, right? And then there's a hinge in the middle. And Eisenberg and other people before him had the neat idea that this is a built-in way to evolve a dimer. Because if you have a deletion here, now this guy can't talk to this guy, right? It can't reach around and talk to it. But if there's two of these floating around the cell, they can domain swap. And the beauty of this model is that you have a built-in, you don't have to evolve the interface, it's already there. And so you just have to have a deletion and you're there. And this has been a popular way of thinking about the evolution of dimers. But I think one has to keep in mind that it's not a one-way street. Because if you're here and then you pick up an insertion, there's no reason you can't go back in the other direction, I think.
But why do we have to have a deletion? If you don't have a deletion, then the upper thing still can form a dimer. It's only the question of concentration again. At high concentration, dimers will dominate.
Yeah.
Low concentration, monomeric state will dominate.
No, I mean, intramolecular interaction is always, intramolecular interaction will always.
Yeah, I understand that intramolecular interaction.
Yeah, if you have like 1,000 amino acids and they're like really far apart, maybe, but in general,
It's true, but if this thing has certain elasticity, if it's not completely flexible.
But that's part of their argument, right, is co-localization. This is how the whole thing got off the ground to start with, because these intermolecular things are co-localized, because they're tied together.
If it's completely flexible, then critical concentration would be roughly equal to intramolecular concentration.
Yeah. So I think you're right. In fact, this is related to another point that I want to make. So that model sort of works pretty good if you're dealing with a bacterial species that's not diploid, because when you make the mutation, okay, that's the only kind of protein in the cell. But what happens if you have a diploid? right? Because now, you know, there's your ancestral state and they're doing this kind of thing. But now you have the first mutation, the deletion in the hinge region. So now you've got two molecules segregating in the cell at the same time. And, you know, when you have a new mutation, it's extremely rare. So it's always in heterozygotes. It's always paired up with this guy in a diploid. And so then the question arises, well, what happens now when you have these two types of molecules? Presumably, you know, some of them are doing this. According to the model, some would be doing this. But what about these guys? So you get these heterotypic mixtures. And so this could be a deleterious intermediate state. And that's the main point that I want to make. If you start making chains for some reason, once you get over here, this might even be better than this. But the problem is, how do you get over there? And so without going through the math, and I will make this the last slide, this is what's called underdominance in population genetics. And so imagine this is the frequency of the domain swapping allele. So initially it's frequency 1 over the number of individuals. And it's very rare. There's not many of them influencing the mean fitness in the population. So this is the average fitness of the population given by this line here. And so now imagine the new domain swapping allele is rising to higher and higher frequency. This means there's more and more heterozygotes in the population. And they're the ones with the bad fitness. And so fitness will decline as the domain swapping allele increases in frequency. It has to under this model. But eventually its frequency will be high enough so that now there's some homozygous individuals, right? Once the probability of a homozygote is the frequency squared. And so once you get to a certain point, now you're home free, fitness increases. And so the problem with this model is somehow you have to get to this point before selection can take advantage of you. And the way natural selection, of course, works is it's going to be dry. So this is, in fact, is the average rate of change of the allele frequency. So if you're to the left of that point, so this is the valley here, the bottom of the valley. If you're to the left of that point, selection's going to be pushing the domain swapping allele out, because it's selection's always operating a way to increase mean fitness. If you can get to that point, then you can be pulled up. And so you can work out the math here. What you have to figure out is what is the probability of drifting against selection? I mean, you have to actually drift against the power of selection. And you can't do that if the population size is large. And so you can work out stuff here. It turns out there's a barrier in terms of population size. You just can't cross the valley because selection's so strong relative to the noise, you can't get there. And so this makes the prediction, at least, that, you know, domain swapping, evolution from a single monomer to a domain swapping dimer in a diploid species would be very, very difficult to do.
And they are pretty rare, these domain swap dimers.
But do you know in eukaryotes, which are often diploid?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I just know in general they're pretty rare. But why is this argument different so I never thought about this before, actually. So this, yes, lots of interesting ideas here. So, but I never, why is that different for just a flat interface that's just normal? Because you'll still have a mutation in a
mean physically?
Well, you'll still have the same mixed populations and like two of A, two of B, and then AB and so on, or AA. So if you just have a flat interface and you have one sticky mutation, like just a normal, this is the common thing, is just have a flat interface, right, pretty planar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the most common scenario. And then you just have the normal, like your normal kind of
so
pressure.
You're talking about this being the interface.
You'll still have like AA, you know, little a will be fine because you'll have the 2-for-1 benefit.
Right.
But a, big A, little a, how will that work out? I mean, why doesn't the same kind of problem apply?
For big A, little a? Well, I'm suggesting there is potentially a problem.
But not for the domain swapping, just the normal ones. Because you'll... the 2-for-1.
What do you mean by the normal ones? This one?
Normal kind of, like, just forget the red domain. let's say we just have blue domains, and
okay.
we just, and they don't look like this Pac-Man, they're just planar interfaces, and then you have a sticky mutation. You'll have one allele will be the sticky one, the other one will be the old one that's hydrophilic and solvent exposed. So then you'll get the sticky ones will stick to each other, right? Oh, okay, yeah. No, sorry. Yeah, it's okay. So you'll just get the affinity between the mutation little a, and the monomers will just kind of be happily floating around. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this issue here is more general too than the domain swapping model. I think the question I'm trying to raise here is, in any kind of transition from a monomer to a dimer, the guy who likes to be a dimer is initially only in cells, if you're a diploid, where the other guy's wanting to be a monomer. And so the main point I'm trying to make is there's a fundamental question. Is there a penalty you pay? Do you have to go through this bottleneck in fitness to get over here? That's the main issue.
But I guess the bottleneck isn't going to be there if it's not a domain swapping.
I don't know. It's possible. Yeah.
So what would your predictions be for this? Organisms that spend some time as diploids and some time as haploids?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that when Sarah was raising your point. It goes beyond that too, because you could get away from if you have a self-fertilizing organism, you could break the barrier, right? Because little a, you start out like this, but you only mate with yourself. A quarter of your kids are little a's.
Right.
So you're potentially home free. Or you could be a unicellular eukaryote with a predominant haploid phase.
Yep.
And so if you could go long enough for it to fix in the haploid phase, that might be a way around it.
So we could test that kind of thing in some situations. For example, the bugs that we work on, toxoplasma, which predominantly replicate as haploids.
Yep.
Which grow only as haploids, and predominantly replicate through vertical transmission without asexual transmission, so without going through a diploid form, but where this varies in different parts of the world than
mm-hmm.
it has for many generations, although measuring generation time in something that's latent forms is just a nightmare.
Yeah, anything that would allow these guys to become enriched so that they're mating with themselves.
Yep.
Or in a half. So there are ways potentially around it, but it doesn't get any better than being a bacterium, I guess.
But you can make some pretty specific predictions in cases where we have allelic polymorphisms that then get into these populations that only replicate as haploids to what the
mm-hmm.
frequency. I don't know if you think more about that, or maybe we can talk about it. But I think we might actually have some data that would allow you to test this from different geographic regions.
Yeah, I mean, it requires a lot of good protein science that still needs to be done. So. Mainly, I wanted to point out, I think this is a very interesting area that in protein biology, that's quite relevant to cell biology. And it's almost not been touched from an evolutionary perspective. And I think we're at the point where we now have some models that, at least I think this is a good example why population genetics is important. It helps reveal what is and isn't possible. And you know, maybe this turns out to be zero, but if it's not, then we've got a problem. So. That's where we are, so I think I should stop for now. Thank you very much.